Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to the Women in STEM podcast, where we celebrate the brilliant minds shaping science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I am your host, Kelly Shungu, and today is truly something special. For the first time, we've taken the Women in STEM podcast live. This conversation was recorded in front of a sold-out audience at Somerset House in London at our event called Women in STEM Celebrating Creativity and Innovation. It was an event filled with one keynote speaker, a panel discussion with three remarkable guests, and seven hands-on workshops. And there were lots of amazing giveaways throughout this event. This incredible celebration of women in STEM was made possible via our sponsors, Engineering Tomorrow and Girl Dreamer. Now we're going to be hearing the panel discussion of this portion of the event.
Thank you all for being here tonight, and thank you for this amazing panel. As I've mentioned, all of these women have actually been on the Women in STEM podcast before, and right now we are recording this live from Somerset House, so I'm really excited and thrilled. This episode is about celebrating women's creativity and innovation, and I feel like each one of you embody that. Can we please go around and just do an introduction, tell me what you do, and what excites you most about your work? Would you like to go first?
Hi everyone. My name is Elaina Bakari. I am a self-taught artist and tattoo designer with a degree in mathematics, and I taught myself to code over 4 years and built an app called Exhibits, which is all of London's exhibitions, museums and galleries in one place, because quite frankly I got sick to death of missing them all the time. So yeah, I run that with my sister Dilara, who's in the audience today, and it's an honour to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yay! Hi everyone, I'm Sabria Karim. I'm a trained scientist, actually, to be precise, a cell biologist. I currently work as a science editor. So a science editor, to sort of translate this term, is essentially publishing research stories, so from the lab out into the world. I made that transition about 4 years ago from doing lab-based research. And what I'm most excited about the field, truly, is just reading the latest discoveries before anyone else, and it reaches my desk first. So it's really wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Emily Wood. I'm a lead software engineer at a media company, but my kind of path into STEM was anything but traditional. I don't have a STEM background. In fact, I have perhaps the most opposite thing you can have, which is one arts degree in English literature and a master's degree in film and screenwriting. But I made the transition in the pandemic, also kind of half self-taught, and I've never looked back since. I love it, and I also think my kind of career and background in the arts is also what sets me apart and makes me a really, really good engineer, and I hope by the end of tonight some of you will feel that way too, who maybe haven't looked at your arts background as a strength before. Thanks for having me.
So tonight's theme is celebrating creativity and innovation. Oftentimes, STEM is looked at as something logical and quite far removed from the arts. And I wanted to know, how has creativity helped you solve problem solving in your work?
Yeah, great. So I was trying to think about like a specific example where creativity had helped me in my day-to-day life as a software engineer. And the truth is, I couldn't pinpoint one because it's literally every single day. So if I kind of think back, when I was in school, maybe some of you are the same. In maths class, I had my textbook, and it's one of those old school ones where you had the kind of the question you had to do at the front of the book, and then you'd flip to the back and get the answers. And I'd always get like 2,764, and the answer was 12. And I was like, ugh. So I thought that being a software engineer would be exactly the same thing. There'd be a right way to do something and a wrong way. There was one answer, it was binary. Turns out, couldn't be further from the truth. So my job is to kind of professionally build things. And in the same way that if we gave every single one of you in this room, you know, a box full of Lego and said, build a tower, you're going to come up with 50 different iterations, the same can be said of software engineering. It's kind of thinking laterally, thinking outside the box about how we're going to solve this problem. And we kind of need a myriad of perspectives. So yeah, it was really tricky to pinpoint one thing, because I would honestly say I get to exercise my creativity every single day.
Yeah, I had to think hard and fast about this question, and I'm going to tell you a story actually from back in my research days. So I am a trained cell biologist. I have a PhD in cell biology. And during those years of doing scientific research is really where creativity came handy. And actually, it was creativity that directed the project that I ended up doing. So a cell biologist usually studies things that have been fixed, so essentially frozen in time, and you look at it under the microscope and try and make inferences. So that's what my project involved. But one big day, we got a new dye, so a new color in the lab, and that was meant for fixed cells. So looking at cells divide under the microscope was something that I was doing a lot. And that part of the project involved working with baby fish. So I was working with fish at some point in the lab. And the protocol was very long, you know, to fix the cells and then add the dye and then look at it under the microscope and to see the structures. And I was being very impatient. And I thought, if we want to look at these structures dynamically, the way to do that is not fixing it in time. It's to look at the dye in the fish life whilst they, you know, move about. So I did this very silly thing, didn't tell my supervisor. So when you do these things, don't tell your supervisor. Just go book the microscope, got a dish of the water that the fish lived in, with the fish floating about inside, swimming rather, and put the dye straight into the dish. And I thought, you know, whatever, let's just look at it under the microscope. So went and shone light on the fish, and lo and behold, they were glowing. They were glowing orange, which was the colour of the dye. And I could see the structures so clearly, actually far more clearly than I did when I eventually followed the protocol and fixed them afterwards. And we ended up moving in the direction of imaging live fish using that dye, and we saw far many more effects, if you like, on the division of the cells, including sort of blebbing, so the structure of the membrane, so which is the outer coat of the cell, had these undulations which were just not visible when you would fix the cells in time. So that brought the project into a completely new direction, which we ended up publishing. But creativity on a day-to-day level, as Emily is saying, is just so important in your work. So allow yourself to think outside the box, even if, you know, it's a bit off the protocol.
Okay, so I was going to say what Emily said, but it might be useful to reiterate it. So I think one of the things, as a software engineer, things are mostly going wrong. That's the truth of it. They never tell you that when you're going into coding, but it's true. I spend 90% of my time debugging what I did. And you have to be really creative, because oftentimes you don't actually know where it's gone wrong. So I don't know if anyone remembers from the textbook example, it was like inputs and outputs, and there'd be like a diagram of some kind of a machine. There'd be like a funnel, and then there'd be like a conveyor belt bit. And it was just to signify that you put a number in at one end, and then all these different things happen to it, and it gets spat out the other side. If that machine were to break, where has broken? The funnel? The conveyor belt bit? You know, there are so many different pieces that go together towards making a code do a certain thing. And you have to be really creative in trying to find the bug, track down the bug. Alternatively, once you've found it, okay, fine, this thing, the funnel is broken. How do I fix the funnel? Okay, well, let me try this thing, right? And then you do it and nothing happens. Sometimes you can actually make the problem worse, which is hilarious. And then you say, okay, fine, well, let me try now another thing. And you kind of, essentially, you just keep going until you fixed it in a manner that you deem, and so does the team, to be suitable. Like, okay, fine, this isn't sellotape, I guess you probably fixed it properly. In finding those solutions, you just really have to try everything. And then there'll come a point where you've tried everything and nothing's worked, and you go home. Sometimes you can cry, it's fine to cry about it. And then you may be like, you know, complaining to your friends at the team, and you'll say, I've tried this thing. And then someone will say something in passing, and you're like, hold on a second, I haven't cranked that lever yet. And then you do, and then it works. And then you're like, oh, it was all worth it. And then you go around and have a cup of tea. So, yeah, creativity is really in, I think, your approach towards problem solving, which can be the way you make a cup of tea when the kettle's broken. It can be the code that you write. It can be fixing the wheel on your bike. And I think women in particular are really, really creative. I think there are times in the month where you're more creative than others, but on the whole, I think, women really make do with what they've got, and that just makes the best problem solvers. That's why we need women in STEM.
Yes. And speaking about creativity, I'm really curious for you to tell us a bit more about your journey as a self-taught coder, how you built the app, whilst also juggling two jobs, which is super impressive. I'm sure that took a lot of determination and creativity. So can you tell us a bit more about your app?
Yeah, absolutely. So my first job at uni, I got an admin job at a tech company that was an app because I wanted to quit that job and move to Spain. So I got a job that I thought they wouldn't be too pissed at me if I left. Turns out, though, they were like, oh, you have a maths brain. We should probably use you in some way. So I did their data analysis for a year. And during that time, they said, do you want to learn to code? And it has been my dream, and I'm very happy to announce that I have lived my dream and will hopefully continue to do so in the future, of working on my laptop on a beach. That's it. That's all I want from my working life, because I don't work in a mine or somewhere where I have to be there physically, so let me enjoy the riches of life. So anyway, I learned to code that job, but I wasn't learning well enough, so I quit my job and put all my savings into a boot camp called LeWagon. And that was the start of 2020. And at this course, by the way, we had menswear tailors, a firefighter, there were like two yoga instructors, just a real mix of people who were learning to code for the first time. So that was awesome. I learned to code for mobile. Essentially, I got a job through the job center and they gave me a course on Flutter. Hadn't heard of it before, didn't really know what it was. And I made my first app and it was called I'm a Cat. And if you find me afterwards, I'll show it to you. It's on my phone. It's an orange background, and there are pictures of two cats on it. That's it. That's the whole app.
Love it.
And I was so enamored with the fact that I could click on a fat orange cat, which I made the icon, and an app would pop up on my phone. And I was like, yeah, this stuff is for me. I'm going to make apps for the rest of my life. So, yeah, at the time, I also didn't have social media. So I missed all the exhibitions you could think of. I just kept missing them. So I thought, if I make my own social media, as it were, in the sense that it's an app that I click on it and it opens up on my phone and I can browse what I want to browse, it's just exhibitions, and then I can close it when I don't want to use it. So began 4 years of battling with Flutter, and I'm very happy to say that we launched the app a year ago, so we've been out for a year, and
yay! Thank you!
So my life's greatest work. There was a lot of remaking. And one thing I want to say before we move on, I don't want to take up all the time, but I once spoke to a guy who said, I've never spoken to a guy ever since, by the way, there's just this one passing comment he made. And I said, I have this idea for an app, but I don't really know enough about coding to make it come to life. You know, I just don't know enough to start. And he said, you'll never know enough to start. And you probably actually have to rebuild it many times before it's finished. So I just ignored that part because I thought that's a little bit daunting. So I just thought, you know what, why not give it a go? So from being able to show cats on a screen, then I was like, okay, well, if I click on an image, I'd like it to take me to a new screen. Let's start there. And then little by little, we've just got a fully functioning app with a map, and it's got a search feature now, and it's super gorgeous and amazing. But yeah, I changed the back end of the app 7 times. So I know a thing or two about the creative process of going round and round, and yeah, eventually you'll get it, I think.
Fantastic. Thank you for that in-depth response. Thanks. To my question. Next, I'm going to head over to you, Sabria. Okay. In the episode that we did together, which is titled, Is a PhD Right for You?, which I feel like some people might be considering a PhD in this room, you were very honest about your experience with doctoral research, about feeling isolated, as well as sometimes facing imposter syndrome. As a cell biologist, I wanted to find out a bit more about how you balance rigorous scientific methods with creativity and innovation, and how do you make sure that you get through to the breakthrough that are needed in your industry?
Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful question, because oftentimes we can think doing rigorous science does not equal to doing creative scientific research, and creativity is very much part of the research process, which hopefully the story that I shared earlier, and that's only one of many, many stories, from other people as well. And my take on it is now as a science editor, if you like, in maybe an unnice way, I have to police research papers that come our way and make sure that they're scientifically rigorous, the conclusions stand. And what does rigorous science mean? Just to clarify the term in the question, it's that whatever findings is reported in a manuscript or a paper can be reproduced. So let's say person X does it in their lab and then person Y does it using the exact same method. It should technically come to the same conclusions and same findings. And that would be what we would call a reproducible, robust finding and or a rigorous finding. But sometimes when we follow these protocols so strictly, it can preclude creativity. But actually, there's a blind spot there because creativity comes first in the process, because that's where the ideas are generated, that's where you allow your mind to run free and brainstorm and do sort of what we call blue sky research, which is might not have an application, but it's sort of for the sake of curiosity. And then we design the method to accurately test this creative idea, and then this is where the rigorous part comes from, where we try and do it multiple ways to come to the same conclusion, we try and do it multiple times to make sure it wasn't just some random weird effect that we see. And so rigor comes afterwards, and I see that creativity and rigor are really hand in hand. Mm-hmm. If one does science, and any part of STEM, I think, without creativity, it will only be incremental, and just rigorous science, it will be incremental findings. But if we do creative science without rigor, then it's a flashy finding, but that doesn't stand the test of time. So ideally, bringing both together, something that is flashy but also stands the test of time, is the ideal, really, for research and for all fields of research. So as a science editor, this is what we monitor. We try and be clear on the rigorous part, but without limiting creativity, and just allowing scientists to explore, but then make sure the process is in place to ensure rigor. So they go hand in hand. Creativity and rigor go hand in hand in science.
Wow, that's not something that I had really thought about in that way, but I'm glad to see the correlation and the links. Emily, I wanted to kind of get into your journey from going from a scriptwriter to becoming a software engineering leadership in a media industry, which is quite fascinating. Are there creative lessons that you learned that you've taken from your degree in scriptwriting that you utilize now, and how has that worked for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it wouldn't sort of at first glance seem apparent that the two have anything in common, right? But they really do. So one of the key facets of screenwriting, the kind of number one lesson they hit you over the head with when you're studying it, is the kind of golden rule is show, don't tell. So you've probably all watched some sort of terrible movie, usually on the Hallmark Channel, not going to lie, usually around Christmas time, where a character gives this massive exposition dump. In fact, you know, action movies are really bad for it. They'll be your action hero will meet the villain for the big climax of the film, and then instead of the villain enacting their evil plan, they'll monologue at them for like 20 minutes telling them what they're going to do. And you're like, why didn't you just do it? Because it would have been done by now. So this facet, this show, rather than tell the audience, is something that really also kind of translates, oddly, into building software. Because I kind of think whenever I'm building something, if it's an app, if it's a piece of software, if it's an API for other developers to consume, if I've built it in such a way that I have to give them really granular details about how to use it, I haven't built it correctly, right? Like, it should be innate from being able to use it. So that's a facet I use every single day in my job. And then I think the other key thing I learned in screenwriting, and something you both touched upon actually, that's really common in software engineering, is this process of iteration. So you'll definitely have seen a writer's room before on the screen, and there's note cards on the wall, those scene cards where they're plotting out how the plot's going to go, act one, act two, act three, this is how the series is going to develop. Well, we kind of break down software and how we're going to build it in the same manner, and so much so that we even call it user stories, right? We use this story terminology when we're breaking down a project, because we have to write what we're going to build in such a way that I can understand it as one of the devs that's going to build it, but also product can understand it and the people I'm building it for can understand it. So yeah, breaking things down and then building, as you were saying, with seven different backends as well, just iterating constantly. Your first draft's always going to be terrible, just like in film. And in fact, when I went to film school, you know, I've got a pact with another screenwriter that's like, you know, if you know, the day that I pass from this mortal world, I need you to break into my home and just burn all the first drafts. There's so many things that I'm less embarrassed about than those first drafts of things I've written. So any writer in the room will know, your first piece is never your best piece. But just like with software, you keep iterating, you keep redrafting, you give it to people, you get feedback, you restructure it, just as we do with code. So yeah, there's a huge amount of overlap, which really surprised me.
Fantastic. We've come to the end of this segment. Thank you all so much for participating in this. Can we give them a large round of applause, please? And so now we're going to do an audience Q&A. We have about 15 minutes, so I hope you guys have questions ready. Don't be shy.
Yeah.
Somebody's got a question over there.
This is for everyone. What's been one pivotal moment in your kind of career experience that's brought you to where you are today?
Who wants to take that big question?
Ooh, toughy. Well, I'm going first. Okay, well, it's in my hand, so I'm a woman of opportunity.
I have already touched on it, but I'm going to double down on it, mostly because I absolutely love this app to bits, and I actually love it more than Exhibits. It was the first app I ever built, my first draft.
Yeah.
I'm a cat, and the reason I love this one is because it's so silly. It's just two pictures of cats, guys. I'm going to show you after, as I promise. But it showed me that I could do it, because prior to this moment, I hadn't built an app before, and I know this app didn't really do anything, but I just loved it so much that I felt inspired to keep trying to make the next one even better. And I think if you get into a place with whatever skill you're learning, I'm also learning the bass guitar right now, it's always been a dream to just jam in a band. If you don't enjoy the thing you're trying to learn, it's quite likely that you won't be learning it for much longer. At some point, you're just going to want to pack it in, essentially. So I think that was a pivotal moment for me where I discovered that I enjoyed building apps. More so than websites, right? Because I did my bootcamp in website design and I was like, yeah, cool, fine. But apps, I was like, oh my God, so cool. So yeah, that was a pivotal moment for me.
So the answer to this question, the honest answer to Stefania's question really touches on something very personal, which I'll share with you as mostly ladies in the group. I never planned to be a scientist, actually, nor a science editor. I mean, there's been multiple turning points, but if I were to think of the one that really put me on this path, it would be to share with you what that was. So when I was much younger, 18-year-old, that's the time we think about what is it we want to go into. I always had this dream and aspiration to go into science, and at the time, my options in my head were very limited. You know, I enjoyed biology and I thought the human body is so cool, so I should go off and become a medical doctor. But at the time, based on the culture and the background, I'm from Mauritius. I don't know if there are any Mauritians in the group, but anyhow, it was sort of the age where you were expected to settle down and get married. And, you know, I was engaged at the time and to be married to somebody, and I didn't think, or I didn't have the confidence as a 17-year-old to say to myself that it's fine to go onto a route to study science or medicine, because it's quite intense. I have a lot of respect for medical doctors. And also balance the responsibilities as, you know, a wife and eventually a mother and having a family. And so I sort of shut that route to science and, you know, shut myself to it, even if, you know, I had the grades for it, because as Elena says, when you enjoy something, you know, you're somehow naturally good at it and you persevere. Anyway, long story short, it was a dramatic end to that engagement, if you like, and something that actually shattered me as a person and took years to sort of rebuild, because you're quite young. Mm-hmm. But I found myself again through pursuing what I wanted to do, which was to go down the route of science and medicine. And I'm not a medical doctor, so there was another turning point where I ended up going into scientific research, which, you know, is a story for another day. But I would say it's that pivotal moment where sort of the marriage went out the window. And the bigger picture here for you all is sometimes stereotypes and set paths that people lay, or, you know, the timelines that you, by this age you have to do this, that and the other, and I know it's more prevalent in certain cultures than others. I didn't go by any of that, and I think that was the biggest... That was the big door opener for me.
Thank you.
Gosh, I can't follow that though. So I guess I would choose one from quite recent past, and I guess a big learning and turning point in how I view myself in my current job and how I'm going to hopefully continue to kind of present myself going forward was, you know, I've often been the only woman in male-dominated teams. I've always mostly had male senior software engineers and tech leads. And quite recently, I was working on a project and I just felt like I was the only woman in our side of the team. And I just felt like I was looking around and I could see every man in my team getting the really meaty work. Really, we had so much on our plate, was really tight delivery deadlines. And I thought, they're just giving me the busy work. They're giving me little tidy up jobs and stuff. And they're all really stressed and under pressure. If I'm a member of this team, I want to feel like a member of this team, but I also want to be given the trust that I can kind of achieve just as the men in my team can. So I had a really scary conversation, and I'm not traditionally the kind of forthright person to do that, but I sat down with my line manager in my one-to-one and I said, look, I think you are underestimating me and I need you to trust me and give me a chance to do something more challenging. And it terrified me, and I went home and had a cry afterwards just from the adrenaline come down. But the next day we came back and he apologised and he said, you know, I've reflected on it too, and you're right, I don't know if I was doing it subconsciously, but let's give you something interesting so you can learn and actually, you know, get the experience you want. And it's been brilliant, and I was able to do it, just as you would be too. So I think that was massive for me and is something that I want to, it scares me, I'm not going to lie, but I really want to keep doing going forward, because don't let anybody restrict you and put you in a box of their design. You know what you're capable of, and I really encourage you, and I think to an extent you kind of have to as a woman in our industry, and I really hope that changes, but I think you have to advocate for yourself. So that was a big moment for me and kind of a big victory, I guess, and a turning point.
Thank you so much.
What an incredible, inspiring panel discussion. I would like to thank all the panel speakers, the keynote speaker, as well as the workshop facilitators and volunteers for helping me make my first ever Women in STEM podcast event possible. Listening back and hearing each individual panel's members' experiences and contribution to this episode has really been inspiring. If you would like to keep up to date with what's happening on the Women in STEM podcast and find out about our next upcoming events, which we will be having plenty more, make sure to follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram. All our links will be in the bio. Thank you for listening to this episode.